thing here. Good morning. Still morning. This is good. Feels like a long day already. This is our time for the board to meet with the address community, ASO, NRO. As is our standard practice, we look forward to these because we like to use the time for rather direct, frank, and substantive conversation. So we can dispense with the platitudes. You guys are great. We're great. We're all great. And just plunge right in. So turn things over to Adil, and it's your meeting.
Thank you.
Can you comment?
Yes.
Could I suggest that we deal with item three first, because the other two are going to consume an awful lot of time? And actually, what that's a sort of a paraphrase of what I asked for. What I'm concerned about is the board has no idea at all about all of the hard work that's going on and inside each individual region and in between regions with regards to the diminishing free pool of IPv4 addresses that exist in the regions and what's being done with regards to transfers in that situation and what will happen with total post-exhaustion and what mechanisms are in place as far as returning stuff to the IANA and redistribution and so forth. But the board absolutely knows nothing about this, and I think it would be well worthwhile for the board to at least learn a little bit.
Yes, thank you, Ray. First of all, thank you. I would like to thank the board again for a meeting with us. It's always an opportunity for us as well to exchange with the board and discuss those issues which are important for us. I just want to reassure you, Ray, that that's the way we understand it, and there will be a small update on that, which will cover all those points. So I think we also all agree. I think it's good to start with that, so that we move to the other point. So have one, the status, two, the roadmap, and three, the agreement between ICANN and the NRO. So for the IP address transfer market and status of how what we have in place among us, I will give the floor to John to give us an update.
So I'll give the brief update because I actually read it literally, but what you talked about, Ray, may have a bigger scope. We may want to have each of the regions go around and spend a couple of minutes describing what's going on. Let me talk specifically about the transfer market so people understand. There is and I'm going to talk about the inter-RIR aspect. There is an active inter-RIR transfer market. It is a globally coordinated policy. Each RIR institutes their own inter-RIR transfer policy if they're interested in having such. It's very much like traveling the globe here. If your plug and the socket fit together, then things work. And so we have some policies that work between the regions. We have some policies that don't work between the regions. And so, for example, in the Iron region, we have a policy that basically says we'll recognize any other region that has a need-based transfer policy and will allow reciprocal transfers in and out. There is such a policy in the APNIC region, so you can go to our website. If you go to transfers, you go to statistics, you go to inter-RIR, you'll see a page of transfers that are shown since last summer that show address blocks moving to the APNIC region because the policies are compatible. With respect to the RIPE region, there isn't a compatible policy, so we don't have inter-RIR transfers going from Aaron to RIPE, and so that's just the way it is. There's no global policy because, well, we don't even have bilateral policies that have a common ground, so how would we have a global policy? But it is getting closer and closer. We're seeing more and more convergence among the policies, among the regions. I imagine in a few years the community will figure out how they want to approach this, but obviously, you have to let the community drive, and they have to figure out where they're going. And That's kind of the transfer, inter-IR transfer aspect. With regards to what's happening with depletion and activities in each of the regions, I'll go first. In the Iron region, we have 1.3/8s remaining. We will, when we get to a single slash 8, get to our final phase of our depletion program. Aaron does not have a reserve. We have a reserve for IPv6 transition technology, a IPv4 address block. So if you're using translation gateways, you can get a block for that purpose. But otherwise, we will actually run out somewhere at the end of this year or early next year. And then parties looking for address space will not be able to obtain it from Aaron's free pool. They'll have to go to the market. Or they'll have to go on the waiting list. There is a waiting list program. We keep a list of all the approved transfers, and we'll process them if and when address space comes back, which isn't all that frequent. So that's in the Aaron region. I guess the other four regions should explain what's happening locally with their address pool.
Sure, and I'll continue. Yeah. Access public from the RAP NCC. We have run out, but then there's a qualifier. We have reserved the last, we call the last slash 8, for the future, a new entrance to the market and the like, and we are allocating from that. The only block size that you can get from that is a slash 22, is about 1,000 addresses. And it works, and the forecasts say we'll be good for a couple of years there still. We do see a pronounced increase in new membership, and we do believe that that has to do with the fact that our members, the ISPs, don't feel able to sub-allocate to their customers, so their customers are being sent straight to our way with the advice to become a member and get their 1,000 addresses and be happy afterwards. So that's what we see. It's an interesting development. It's good. More members means we can split the cost of the RIPE NCC across more, so the fees go down. Everybody seems to be happy with that, so there is no big issue at this time. Thank you. Next.
I'll go this way, and then Paul will be...
It's situation with APNIC is very much what you've heard already. Very briefly, we have run out of our normal supply of V4. We do have a last slash eight policy, which gives small allocations, only one per organisation who asked for it. That's I describe it as a rationing of our final pool. That's expected to last for many years, and we're going through it at a steady rate, but it's quite a reasonable allocation. The idea of it is to be to carry through pretty much the entire IPv6 transition, so there is always V4 address available. To those who need it until such time as people don't need it anymore. So it's not actually expected to be exhausted, but we don't know. We're doing transfers. We're processing transfers from Aaron. We're processing a steady, fairly low rate of regional transfers, less than one a day, a handful per week of transfers at the moment. They're all reasonably small. I think... the market, such as it is a long way from being sort of stable and well understood. It seems that a per address pricing is okay for people who want to spend a small number of thousands of dollars on a small transfer, but when you scale that up to the large blocks that are available, you're really talking about tens or even tens of millions or even higher than that. And clearly that's the kind of money that you start to worry about security and how exactly that's going to be financed, and that is not happening. So I think we don't have a clue as to what happens in future. We don't have a crystal ball there. Just very glad to see that the indications for IPv6 are exponential growth at the moment, still from a low base, but when you look at Google's figures hitting 3% and projecting forward to 10% or so within a year, it's pretty good. So I think while we still are very concerned not to lose momentum on IPv6 deployment, we actually are, as to the extent you can say, we're on track, I think. I think that's all from APNIC. Thanks.
Andres?
This is Andres from LACNIC. First of all, I want to... I have a message from Raul. He regrets not being able to be here due to personal commitments. So that's the first thing. this also considering the our situation. This year we are running out. From the last 3 years, the expectations were the this year in May we will run out of our current pool, and they remain being the same expectations. So the trend will or may be modified if there is if this process accelerates. But we are very, very close to May, so we believe that in our Cancun meeting we will facing our run out. We also have a process soft landing policy, and we will have for newcomers little allocations that will, I guess, last for a couple of years. Also, we don't have any transfer policy. This didn't came up at the region yet. It has been discussed. Also, it has been discussed not only in the LACNIC forums, but at the IGF last year. And the region is not yet demanding for a transfer policy, but we may see the changes about this maybe this year. So we are expecting to help the process to be successful if this is a need from the region in the future. And we are trying to focus in IPv6. We know we are a little behind compared to other regions. Our adoption is not hasn't good numbers yet, but we saw the evolution, for example, of the North American region that was behind a couple of years ago, and we understood that there is a path. The market is also concentrated, so we are trying to focus in the top 100 of players that maybe they could move the number higher in the future. So, and we are working also with governments outside our own policies. It's just an active strategy in promoting the possibility of accelerating the IPv6 deployment, and we are focusing our efforts there. Thank you.
Thank you all. So the situation in our region is a little bit particular. First thing, we still have a more than 3/8 in our free pool. So we have the biggest free IPv4 pool right now. That may explain the fact that we don't have a transfer policy. The policy has been proposed twice already, which has been consensually rejected by the community at this point of time, for obvious reason. We do have a soft landing policy as well in our region, which secure a last slash eight to be able to cater for last comer to the market and ensure them they have sufficient IPv4 for their transition to IPv6. So we, however, are putting a lot of effort still in promoting IPv6 and helping operators in the region to adopt IPv6, because we believe that no matter how much IPv4 we have, when the rest of the world will move to IPv6, we won't have choice to process and manage our network or deploy our network using IPv6. So we are doing that as well, and we are seeing a lot of progress in that. I will also probably come back to the transfer aspect and maybe raise what is our challenge there and why there are those inter-area transfer and transfer policy within the region. One of the challenges that transfer market poses is the accuracy of the information in the registry, the registration information. one thing that we want to make sure is that when there are transfer, there is a way for those who are involved in those transfer to accurately register those information in our database, because our responsibility and role is to maintain an accurate registration of the use of IP numbers. If there is no formal way to do that, those transfer will happen under the table, and the information that will be publicly available on those resources won't reflect the reality. So that's why it is important when the transfer market, you know, become needed, that there are policy and there are mechanisms to allow the transfer to happen openly and give people the way of registering those transfers. In our region, we haven't seen much transfer yet for two reasons. First, we don't have a lot of legacy space registered in Afrinic regions, so people don't have more than what they need to transfer. We have, however, seen some attempt to get resources in the region and then transfer them later because the need is not in the region, which puts a little bit more, I would say, pressure on us in the evaluation and due diligence when we evaluate requests that are coming in right now. So that is the official part of the thing. We will be happy to answer any question.
I would also like to hear about the implementation of the global policy with regards to the return of IP addresses to the IANA and the subsequent reallocation of those addresses. So if someone could talk to that, please.
Okay. Yeah, we have that policy, which is a global policy, which allow us as RIR to return address that are recovered after the central pool exhausted to IANA, for IANA to be able to reallocate, reassign them to area who request them. That policy is implemented. We have received recently a communication from IANA to clarify some aspect of the policy on when exactly they will start allocating this. There is a specific mechanism to identify how much IP address can be received by an area that is requesting IPv4 space from recovered space at the IANA level. That clarification has been requested by IANA. We have gone through a consultation in our different region to get everybody on the same line on that. We have forwarded, the ASO has forwarded its response to IANA, and I think that will be used to start that process of allocation. And I'm not sure which area has requested from that free pool yet. I don't think any. So the pool is still there. There is a global policy to manage that, but we haven't tapped into it yet because the area who have run out are still in their last pool, so people still have access to those resources, and the rest are still using their normal IP slash it. Question? Yeah.
That's an excellent tour de table of the state of affairs now in each of the regions. If we step back and take a slightly broader look, what do we know about the trajectory? And it seemed to me that the aftermarket for IPv4 addresses is going to interact with the uptake of IPv6. And I'm not an expert at this, and I don't spend very much of my time looking at it, but I have not seen anything that is a kind of dispassionate and relatively careful assessment of the dynamics and the state of affairs and possible scenarios, futures, pro and con. Are there experts looking at this and building models? And yep.
So short answer is no, Steve, there is not. We have an interesting circumstance in that there's at least two communities that make decisions directly affecting V6 deployment and a third that's indirectly affecting V6 deployment. The two direct communities are service providers deciding whether or not to use IPv6 as their infrastructure and or for their customer services, whether or not they're going to provide V6 all the way to the customer. And this is making actually very good progress. There's a lot of ISPs who have looked at the long-term interesting economics of V4, and as much as you can go get another address block, you can't reliably and cost-effectively serve the customers, even if you get another address block short-term, long-term, it's very difficult, particularly when you have some number of customers who are specifically asking for V6. If you've got to specifically turn on V6 anyway and cover the economics involved in that, it's difficult to try to say it's not worth supporting it as a service across the board. So there's no dispassionate analysis, but if you look at actual decision-making of service provider networks, you have a number of service providers, cable companies, mobile phone operators who have actually said V6 is inherent to their platform, they've turned it on and they've adopted it. And so the parties who haven't done that are the exciting risk takers, because if you don't turn on V6 on your infrastructure, you don't take the plunge, you don't pay attention to it, things are easier because you just go get V4 addresses for a short time. But you can't do that forever, and you're deferring a lot of effort, a lot of planning, a lot of engineering, you're deferring. So at the point in time when V4 doesn't become tenable, then suddenly you find yourself on the wrong side of 5 years of deferred capital investment or 6 years of deferred capital investment. So there's no dispassionate analysis, but we're actually seeing the service provider community one by one slowly make the decision.
Is there anybody tracking the story that you're describing so that the one could see kind of a map or some sort of table of service providers and what their state of...
Some of that's tracked by ISOC and the World IPv6 Project. A lot of people use Google's actual IPv6 traffic demand towards their Google services as an indication of deployment. You can go actually look at that curve. That curve is beginning. It's definitely geometric. It might be exponential, and it's now passing 3.5% It's growing up very rapidly. So I would say the Internet Society maintains the best provider-by-provider information I know of.
You said there was more than just the ISPs. There was another major driver somewhere.
Well, the content, at the end of the day, the content is actually the most important thing, because if you're a service provider and you connect someone up, for example, there's a major service provider who's switched to Android phones, they're using V6 as their infrastructure. They're actually simplifying their infrastructure. So I just came from the Paris World IPv6 Congress. Excellent presentation showing how you can actually lower your traffic, your expenses, lower your engineering by using V6 for the handset. The problem is that whenever they go to a V4 website, some percentage of the traffic goes to V4 and has to be gatewayed back. So if you really want to deploy IPv6 and make it really easy for service providers to make a decision to use V6 as their infrastructure, work on the content. Get all the content sites as quickly as possible dual-homed. Now, we have some of the big ones. You know, World IPv6 Day, the initiative that ISOC helped lead, got a lot of the major top Alexa sites. But there's a lot of businesses that have no idea that their existing website should be dual-homed. So I know in the Aran region we're doing major outreach in that area, totally to content providers, to get them to put their website on the entire Internet and not just the IPv4 Internet. I don't know, Ron, if you want to talk about the service provider view or what you... No?
I've taken too much of your time already.
Yeah, there's plenty that could be said, and we could go on talking about this for another hour or day or more, for sure. I just noticed that it just occurred to me that we've got this technical experts group meeting this afternoon. That might be a time to actually talk in more detail about this this IPv6 transition.
We were so worried we'd have nothing to talk about, so please do come.
Right. Well, plenty to talk about. Thanks.
So thank you for that. If there is no more question on the IP address IPv4 transfer market, then we can move to the other point of the agenda. Yeah? Yes, Steve? Okay.
Yes.
So the second point now is the roadmap for ICANN consultation process related to the transition of the INF function. We would like. We know that the process is on the way, but we want to discuss with you at the board level. How do you see this going forward, and especially what we are concerned about or what we want to discuss is how we can formally input to the process using our different regional mechanism of consultation to plug into the wider process that is being put in place. And related to that, we have other very specific question as well on, for instance, upcoming global event like IGF, how ICANN is going to use those events in this process. This is important for us because that will allow us at regional level, at each area, to know how we conduct our own process to make sure that it is aligned with what is happening globally and make sure that it is taken into consideration, and then we have a review mechanism to make sure that those comments are taken into consideration. So,
I'm going to leave this open for others to respond. I'm taking up way too much of the...
Thank you, Adiel. If I could just, for the record, so we are all on the same page, we are struggling with this within ICANN, so I ask if we can also get your help on this. We do not want to use the term INA transition because it gets people thinking about all kinds of things. We are talking about the transition of the USG stewardship of INA functions. If we could just stick to that language, it makes us, you know, at least aligned in how we communicate this to the world. So you will see that we did not use the term transition of INA in our schedule, in our slides, and I hope we just stick to that kind of key focus. We are transitioning the NTIA stewardship or USG stewardship of the INA functions. Some people are using the word oversight. That's fine as well. The U.S. government is not very keen on that word, but it is what it is. You know, it is USG / oversight. Teresa Schweinhardt is the ICANN executive that is in charge of facilitating the consultation. I emphasize the word facilitating. We are honored and humbled that the U.S. government chose us to facilitate, but we are just a facilitator. Guaranteed failure for us in this effort would be if it looks like ICANN led it, and ICANN engaged the ICANN community, and ICANN came up with a solution. That's failure. And failure is not an option here for a reason. Let me be very direct here. Yes, people are saying the deadline, there is no deadline. And yes, there is no deadline. We should not feel like a guillotine is on our head here. We should do the right thing. Having said that, there's something small that happens in the United States around November of 2015 called the presidential elections. 2016. And when these happen, a lot changes. And who is in charge? Who is at NTIA? Who is in the White House? Who is in State Department? Could all be up for change. So I think it's incumbent upon us to try and plan towards the 18-month window we were given. If we don't achieve it, it's not the end of the world. We can find an arrangement with the U.S. government to continue. They're not pulling a plug on that day. We should function con calma, you know, calmly, get through this process, ensuring inclusivity. I was just challenged at the GAC by you know whom about our inclusivity, you know, that this will be an inclusive process, that everyone will participate, that And so it is very, very important. And I need to stress this, that we need your help. We need your help. Because you and the CCTLDs really are our conduit to the world. ICANN has a global footprint largely. You have a very local footprint and a regional footprint. We need you to help us. And the design of the consultation is not ICANN's. You know, Adiel and the rest of you in the RIR community, that we've been working in lockstep to make sure we are aligned as a group into how the consultation will also work. It is crucial. It is our failure. It's our Achilles heel. If we do not cooperate and involve your communities from the get-go, not later, not as an after-fact, we have to attend, bring the consultations to you. We cannot ask you to come to our consultation. We have to come to your communities. We have to spend time with them. You will do the same with your own communities, of course, and you know, nothing precludes that. But we, ICANN, should be actively coming to you and spending time with you and listening to you. I was struck yesterday that Assistant Secretary Strickling proposed to the Brazilians, just to show you how keen he is on this, that they should actually take a portion of the meeting at Net Mundial and focus it on that, so that there is a public consultation with the world that is perceived to even be outside ICANN, RIRs, IETF, so everyone is welcome. Of course, we don't want to spend the whole Net Mundial on this, but maybe take an hour and a half, and say to everybody, here's a public consultation. And I'm going to speak to the Brazilian government and organizers this afternoon to ask for this, if they agree, and I hope they will, and I'm sure they will. We need you there as well. So again, it's not ICANN leading the consultation. ICANN is simply facilitating. Your presence is paramount. So timing, I commented on. Inclusivity, I commented on. We coming to you, I commented on. This, I call these principles in general. The principles the U.S. government gave us are immovable. Today, South Africa in the GAC challenged me on that. They said, the U.S. government is putting a conditional. And I said, look, they've been gracious enough to give up control. How many of us do? So they gave up control and they put general principles. Which of these principles do you disagree with? We should challenge our communities. Do you disagree with the openness of the internet? If you do, then you shouldn't be part of this consultation, because that's a core principle. Anyway, so we should be pushing these principles in our communities and standing behind them with strength, because they are good principles, every one of them. Anyway, these are my comments, Adiel. I hope this is helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Freddy. These are helpful. I think we have two comments, Paul, and then go on.
I just have some personal perspectives about where we are, being here at ICANN again and talking to the board again and talking to the community. And there's, I think, a bunch of messages which we're repeating, as we do often at ICANN. And I have to remind myself of a principle of adult education, that repetition is more necessary than it is with kids. So, you know, we're coming back to some of the same points. But I've said numerous times that in response to questions about the Montevideo statement, that there's really nothing new in there, that we've collected together a bunch of things that, at least as far as I think APNIC and I think the NRO have wanted to say, that we've said before. And in fact, the same thing actually goes for those statements that came out of the most recent the Santa Monica statement, because we have affirmed our support for ICANN in the past. We've affirmed our satisfaction with the IANA arrangements, with IANA performance, with the bundling of IANA functions, etc. We've said these things before, and we've said that we've said them before, but we're repeating again that we've said them before, hopefully it sinks in eventually. The other thing that bears repetition again is that the difference between numbers and names, things like the fact that we have in the numbers system a structural separation of policy entirely from ICANN and IANA. So ICANN receives policies from the ASO, ratifies those, hands them to the IANA, and as customers on the other side of that policy arrangement, it's very clear to us when policy, if and when policies haven't been followed, we've got really a clean interface there that we like to have always understood because it works. Another thing that I've pointed out a few times this week, to the surprise of some, is that the US government doesn't approve any IP address allocations from the IANA. And sometimes it's assumed that they do, you know. So it's a case of being really clear about the difference between names and numbers, because we've heard a lot of talk these days about changes to IANA or IANA transition or US government role in IANA and et cetera. And most of what's been said about those things apply to names in IANA and not to numbers or protocols and parameters. So, you know, the risk of sort of exerting some set of changes to IANA that affect everything that IANA does for the sake of names is something that we really want to avoid. So the RARs are, I think we're all dedicated to our numbers role and dedicated absolutely to the stability and the security of the numbers services that come from the IANA, and we just need to keep repeating that as well. Personally, I think what we need to do between now and September is to be reviewing the various relationships that we have with ICANN and IANA and how those things are expressed, and making sure that they're expressed accurately and properly as in today's requirements, and changing, amending, updating, renewing them as we need to in whatever form that happens. And I don't know that we've got any clear direction about what the form of those, those relationships, in what form those relationships should be expressed. I've got a fairly simple view, to be honest, of accountability. I think accountability comes from the duty of someone to account to someone else for what they do, and the relationships we have should describe accountability in terms of what ICANN is, how ICANN is to be called to account for under those agreements, and vice versa for that matter. But I think, again, I see our relationship as being a pretty straightforward affair where we can define these things quite well, and I find that a lot of the discussion this week has really been around much, much more complex issues that don't apply to us, and I'd like it to be understood what those differences are from the RIR and numbers case from the names. Thanks.
If I could, Adil, just to respond to this, I want to clarify something you said, Paul. So I'm with you that we need to make sure that the global consultation on the transition of the U.S. government role of oversight over the IANA functions does not include a review of our relationships with you. It does not. That's part of why we drew that big, simple slide with green boxes very clearly saying these are... So people will try, quote-unquote, to push us there. And I had the same discussion this morning with the route operators. People will try to drag us all into that public consultation. We need to resist that. Now we're talking about public adult education a million times. We need to say the public consultation that the U.S. government asked us to do is on our accountability for these functions, but the relationship between the RIRs and ICANN that has been there for a long time and is established and is well understood is not in play here. Now, when people then come and discuss our overall accountability as an organization, Paul, they may bring up other things, not just our, and that's fine, that's fair. I think we should be cognizant of that. But the homework we have from the U.S. government to go back to them with a proposal does not include a review of our agreements with you. Is that your understanding, Paul, and RIRs, or am I misunderstanding this? This is very important.
The nuance is... As Assistant Secretary Strickland said last Friday, is while it is true that this is simply a plan for the transition of the stewardship, there's a symbolic aspect to it about accountability of the whole system. And so the question that will come up will be, while we're doing the homework assignment, how do we also pragmatically handle people who have things outside that homework assignment? How are those channeled? How are those processed? And how does that come to fruition as well in a time frame that we don't end up with a successful homework assignment to the U.S. government, but a symbolic gap in accountability?
I'm terribly sorry, Dale. I want to understand this, because if I don't, it's a problem. Then I'll go out and say the wrong things. So is it your, then, what you just said is that, A, you agree that the public consultation process that Teresa will facilitate and you will all help us with does not include a review of our relationships? That's a separate channel that may happen. But are you also suggesting that, aside from telling people it's perfect, leave us alone, it works, that we may need to actually look at our relationship and strengthen it in some way? Is this something you're saying yes, Axel?
I just want to do a quick response. So our relationship has two aspects, but the relationship with regard to IANA services is a service relationship, and the IANA contract has the U.S. government providing very pragmatic oversight to that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm actually, as I've told people before, I have absolutely no worry about that, because it's a service relationship. It has a direct customer. Yeah. Whether the rest of the world wants to provide oversight or not, we're going to, and we already do. If there was a mistake made in the IANA, we would all be talking to each other very quickly about making sure it was done right. We've never had that problem, but I'm not worried about the oversight of the service that I can provides the IANA function. So the service and the oversight of that is our relationship and what is in the IANA function contract right now.
And if people expose that, if today somebody asked you or any of you publicly, you have oversight in your contract over the IANA implementation of your policies, you will say yes. And if they say, explain this to us, walk us through how you do that oversight, walk us through what you do, is it visible, is it accountable, is it recorded, does it have audit mechanisms, does it have escalation procedures? If they asked us these questions today, my hope would be that we would tell them, yes, here they are, and they would look at them and say, that's perfectly adequate, or we'd like to add to it. So is it our job then to look at these together and relatively quickly, and make sure that when these are exposed in 3 months to the world will look at them and say, this looks pretty good. We're going to add maybe some visibility to us or something like that, and we're okay. But we should be prepared, because we're going to be asked very specifically, tell us how, I mean, am I making myself clear?
If I may. I understand what you're saying, and that is my opinion as well. We have agreements, we have the MOU with ICANN, which is great,
yeah.
And we have good working relations with IANA, and we are happy with the way they're working, and we understand we get along very well. I don't think that latter part is very, very visible.
Right.
And we have point two on the agenda, which speaks to that. We should make it more visible, but that's between the two of us.
Yes, that's between the two of us.
Yeah, that is fundamental. That's why we have the 2 points laid down like that, so to make sure that we know what we are touching on. I have Cole. I don't know if you still want in the queue. And
well, I think this is very good communication. You know, regarding for the what defined the transitions among our, you know, the ASOR, NRO, and to ICANN. I think this is wonderful communication, and I'd like to raise one and two issue and the. I need ASO or the IR to think about it. Is in the NTIA announcement, he also talking about it's not only in the ICANN community or, you know, this community which you explore to more. And have you thinking about who we should explore more to invite them into this you know, discussion. For example, I just said, for example, what about, you know, invite some of the, you know, industry people or something like that. Usually it's not in the, if we still generate the people from the ICANN community, they will say, well, you are only limited to in the ICANN community and, you know, NRO community. So we need to do something to find, to identify what is the other institution or whatever, and bring them in into the discussions. So I think this is the first question. I think we don't need to identify now, but we need to think about it. And the second ball, I think, is also important. I think Paul and many of them, you already talking about that. Actually, a lot of people question about the NTI announcement because many of them, they don't understand the IANA function. What is the IANA office doing? So we have to do some awareness promotion to the outside world to understand what is the IANA administration doing. You know, just I always say, many people actually over-imagine what is IANA magic is. You know, so I think this is a part of our job to make awareness to outside world. Here's the IANA administration. Just like Paul, you say again and again, you know, it's the same thing. We still need to communicate to the outside world. And of course, a part of the job is ICANN. We have to have, you know, a much better IANA report provided to the general public. Here is what we did every day. And don't make an imagination. Don't thought about we have a secret button, you know. So I think this is the second thing we might be need to work together to, you know, to do the work. Thanks.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the critical aspects as well of the role of ICANN in this, in pushing the awareness to people before involving them into this, and I think that will request a lot of outreach activity on which, as RAR regionally, we will be more than happy to support, because, quote, you're right, a lot of people see this as a, you know, a huge thing with a magic button that will shut down everything, just if somebody touched the button, which is not the case, and we have to be very clear, yeah, and explain that specifically, and we can do that from the number perspective, because that is what we do. For instance, as Paul say, you know, the U.S. government is not involved in number at all. Nobody knows that, so that needs to be explained. We have to explain the relation with our policy development process, etc. So there is a huge aspect of outreach, of awareness that is needed outside of the ICANN community itself. So that is a valid point.
Thank you, Adil. I want to go back to a point that Paul was making about policy. And I had a brief opportunity to do this Monday, in that there are actually two kinds of policies involved with everybody. One is the policy that is generated that tells the IANA what to do, which are a very, very small number of policies, really. I mean, the most simplistic way of looking at this in terms of, for example, the GNSO is that the only policy that really concerns about what the IANA is going to do is that when they are presented with an accredited unique string, put it in a root. That's the IANA policy. All this other stuff about trademark clearinghouses and all the rest of that stuff has to do with how you get to the point of that string, and that's a GNSO conundrum. The bulk of the policies that are performed inside the addressing community, inside the IETF community, if you want to use the term policy there loosely, or inside the GNSO, have to do with the administration and management of the resource. That's what you spend all your time doing. And so there are very, very few policies that actually pass the test of going through a process to in the terms of the addressing community, become global policies, in that they have to pass muster and they have to be passed by the ICANN board. Everything else doesn't. And that is true in the ITF. It's not true with the GNSO, and that's something that needs to be fixed in a different conversation. But I also want to point out from the accountability standpoint, every time at in the IP addressing world, when a policy is set to IANA, there's accountability features in it. And those accountability features are, in fact, that they require the IRRs to demonstrate a need. And at that time, when you go ask for something, the IANA actually is conducting a very mini audit, what your need is. And so that is accountability right there. And so we need to point out the fact that our policies also provide for accountability. And so I think that if we spent time doing the education, that, that we would be very, very well pleased. So thank you.
Thank you very much. So that kind of introduced us to the last point, which is the form of strengthening our relationship, of formalizing, documenting, better documenting that relationship with ICANN. We currently have a few mechanisms out there. We have the ASO MOU, we have the exchange of letter of 2007, and our question or expectation is to look at those and see how we can consolidate them, how we can evolve them, or document what we are doing, which is part of our relationship, but also part of the oversight or accountability mechanism that we have now, which is exercised through us as RAR individually, but also through our community, because anything we do related to our relation in regard to the IANA function, we report that back to our community, and our community play an important role because this oversight has to be seen as well from the bottom to the up. So that is the second aspect. How can we strengthen that? How can we formalize that and consolidate all the mechanisms that we have now so that it is easily accessible by people, visible, and straightforward to the point? Yes, Ray.
I think you're forgetting the third document that exists. There's this it's an agreement between ICANN and the regional registries with regards to how you do your business with IANA. We put it together. I believe it was the last time was about 2004, and so that is a relationship document that exists. And so I think it'd be well served to look at that, because it's in that document. There's a lot of accountability features as well. And so I would be hesitant to, for example, to open up the ASO MOU. I would certainly think that looking at the exchange of letters is probably something that you really want to do, because when we did that many, many years ago, it was as lightweight as possible. We both basically recognized each other's right to exist, and that was about it. And so I think that doing it in the exchange of letters, as far as defining accountability relationships, might be the way to go. But I would also look at that third document and see what has to be done with that.
Yeah, exactly. So that is the kind of roadmap of point we want to discuss. To first of all, see if the board is okay for us looking at those documents and start working on them right away to be able to. Yes, Fadi?
I'm addressing Kuo-wei and certainly Ray and our chairman. So the way we do that, you want to do this through maybe the board asking the ASO to start that process? Do we do it straight? I don't know how to do this, but we'll let our board members and help me how we start that process. But I would like to say something about several comments. On the education piece, I already asked Elise to put together an actual course. ICANN now has an actual education platform called learn.icann.org. We're going to put a course, kind of an IANA 101. An important part of that course would be to also put the RIRs all of you explaining the mechanisms by which you keep us accountable. I think it's important people understand that. Now, if these mechanisms are going to evolve through our discussions of number two, then maybe we'll wait till we have the final mechanism. But it's important people understand how you keep us in check today. So I'm committed to that, and I could ask for your help, please. I'd like to revise these materials with you before we publish them, if it's okay. On the second point, on the timeline, first I need the guidance from our board as to how we start that dialogue with you formally. And second, I would beg that the timeline of number two is not tied to the 18 months of the U.S. government. Otherwise, it would clearly show that the two are tied. In fact, I'm hoping that we can proceed with number two as soon as we're all ready, and hopefully no later than London when the high-level meeting. You know, London is key because there's going to be on the 23rd, on the first day of our meeting, a high-level meeting of all governments in the world coming together to see kind of how are we proceeding with our effort. It would be good at that meeting to have some. I don't know if that's too early or something, but it's up to. I'm not imposing a deadline. I'm just suggesting that this may be politically a good point to announce that we have concluded that dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we have no issue moving very fast on that. In fact, we that is our expectation. In fact, to be able to do that as soon as possible, because in many cases there are already document or language which exists around those things. We just need to formalize the documentation and move forward.
Two small points. I too think that moving quickly is helpful. The more stuff that we can put in place, clear away some of the brush, and the better off we are. During the discussion about the relationship between ICANN and the RIRs remains the same. John raised the issue of the appearances of related to stewardship. My thoughts were going down to more concrete things. I don't know how many people actually know exactly how much oversight, stewardship, whatever, NTIA has actually exercised on behalf of the address community. Certainly one of the specific artifacts, visible artifacts, is the report that the IANA group prepares on a regular basis on the number of transactions and so forth that are related to, I mean, they do it across the board for everything they do, and one relatively modest-sized portion of that is address transactions. If I recall, a recent one says no address blocks were allocated, and that would seem to be the end of it. maybe there was something on ASN, on AS numbers. But what I don't know is whether or not there's any feedback. So Elise, you're the one that can speak to this. Whether there's any feedback or other actions that the NTIA folks engage in with respect to anything that could be viewed as stewardship of the relationship between your function and the address community.
Basically, there's no active review of process on how we allocate numbers to the RIRs by the Department of Commerce or by NTIA. And the report you're quoting is one that's not a public report, Steve. It's one that goes privately to NTIA. And the public report is one that was built on performance standards that we put out for public consultation, and that the RIRs gave us feedback, and we set some timeliness and accuracy targets, KPIs, and we've been publishing the report on that for, I guess it's now 5 months, based on the public consultation. And I think in that time there have only been two number allocations, and they were autonomous system number allocations. There have been some multicast allocations, which are under the IETF umbrella and not under the RIR umbrella. Does that answer your question, Steve?
Yes.
Bye.
But I think it's part of the education.
Yes. I just wanted to catch you before you left.
That was due in this room 15 minutes ago, and they're getting a little bit anxious outside to come in and continue their meeting.
Oh, it's not that I have to be somewhere else. Everybody else has
to be. Adele, tell them to be anxious for one more minute. Adele, I want to use this moment to thank you and the RIR leaders for the incredible partnership you have shown me in the last few difficult months. Really, my personal thanks to each one of you and to my board members, both Ray and Kowe, for guiding me through, frankly, me not understanding a lot of the history and the details and being patient with me as we negotiate and respecting, you know, and my hat off especially to John, who's in D.C., respecting the fact that we agreed together that ICANN will be the interlocutor to the U.S. government. And till the last second, you have, and I thank you for that, really thank you for that. Our partnership now in the next few months is even more important, because if we are not aligned and strong together, and you saw that I used you to protect the discussion on Monday, right? You noticed that when people were attacking some of the boxes on the slide saying, why can't we get into that box? I said, this is defined by the RIRs. This is not for us to discuss here. So you are our back and we are your back. And on that basis, let's continue this partnership. And thank you sincerely for being patient with me personally during a tough period.
Thank you very much.
I suggest we hold this room for another 30 minutes so we can have a real numbers controversy at ICANN.